Because often it's said that one of the hardest things to do is to change somebody else's mind. Or, personally, to change your own mind. To have somebody present something in such a way that you change the way you think. One of the reasons it's hard is because for you to change, you have to acknowledge that I must have been wrong. And so changing your mind means admitting you were wrong about something and then accepting what you now believe to be correct. So I think the handouts have been given out, and it starts off by saying there's a world of people who believe different things that we consider, things that we consider to be true, they consider to be false. And the world full of people include people like our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters, our husbands or wives, our friends, our co-workers, people on the street, people in the same city that we live in. There's all sorts of people, some close to us and some not close to us, who don't believe the same as we do. And what can be especially devastating is when it tends to be someone in your own family or someone that's in your close circle of friends, and they shake their head and they say, I don't understand how you think that way. I don't understand why you believe that. And so today's message on how to change a mind hopefully will give us some tools that we can put in the toolkit so that when we encounter situations where we hope to change someone's mind, help them come to an understanding, that we'll have some tools to be able to accomplish that. The Apostle Paul in Romans 12:2 says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God." So the idea that Paul is getting to there is that we in the church, our mind has been transformed. It's been renewed. And that we have taken the time to prove certain things. And so the mind that we have is not going to be the same as the mind of others that we might encounter, whether it's even family members or close friends or co-workers. In 2 Corinthians 2:16, Paul goes further and he talks about this and he says, "For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him?" So that's the question. Who can know God's mind? And then he goes on and he answers it and he says, "But we have the mind of Christ." So he answers it and says that we have the mind, we have the understanding, we understand a bit about how God thinks, what his goals are, we understand his laws, we understand the holy days, what his plan is for mankind. We understand a lot. So it's interesting that Paul is talking about how is it that we can understand these elements of God? Well, we understand because we have the mind of Christ. And so again, we immediately think, well, how do we have that? And Paul goes on in some of the earlier verses, just before verse 2:16, and he explains how that comes about. The first part is what might be titled the revelation. So in verse 9, if we just back up a few verses, it says, "But as it's written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to them through his Spirit." So the first part of our understanding of God and his ways comes by what's revealed to us through his Spirit. "For the Spirit searches all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man, except the spirit of man which is in him?" This is something that is fairly unique knowledge to the Church of God, where we understand that there's this trait, this quality, this element that's part of mankind called the spirit in man, and it helps us understand physical things. It helps us understand not necessarily spiritual things. That comes in the next verse. But it helps us understand physical things. And going on, it says, again, starting with verse 11 once again, "For what man knows the things of man except the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the spirit of God. Now we have received, not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God." So in our quest to be able to impart information, to change the minds of people around us, we have to realize that there's a limitation. That sometimes spiritual knowledge, knowledge about spiritual things, might be given as a gift to us by God and might not yet be given to other people. And so when we're trying to change minds, there's perhaps two categories. One category is spiritual things, and we can do our best to express those spiritual things. And then the other category is physical things. And again, we can do our best, and there are some techniques to help us to express our ideas in a way that might not always convince somebody, because if I had the ability to change everybody's mind on any subject I chose, that would be awesome, but it's beyond our capabilities. Nobody has that gift. But it's important, it is important, especially when you're dealing with family members, to be able to express, here's what I believe and here's why I believe it. And for them to say, okay, I don't agree with that necessarily, but I do understand now why you believe what you believe. And it's reasonable that you would do that. So if you believe the Bible, it makes sense that what you believe would make sense. And so the hope through the message today is to allow us to come to a meeting of minds with the people that we come into contact with. A meeting of minds so that some of the ideas that we might be expressing are not necessarily crazy or goofy or whatever, but hopefully that they can have an understanding of. And hopefully we'll have some tools that are expressed that allow us to be able to communicate with people. This ties in with two different messages that we've had recently. One message is from Murray, talking about the subject of communication. And the idea of changing minds is very much about communication. The other message deals with evangelism. We have knowledge. God has granted us knowledge about Christ, about God's plan, about the right way to live our lives through God's commandments that the rest of the world doesn't have. And so we have the opportunity and the obligation as Christians to share that knowledge with people that we can help with that knowledge. So to continue, we've talked about how there's revelation from God that gives us knowledge. In verse 13, we also understand that there's inspiration from God. Paul says, "These things also we speak, not in words, which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual." And so here we're getting the idea that we're inspired sometimes with what words we're going to be saying. And we need to be open to the Holy Spirit working with us sometimes to have the right words when we're communicating with people. And the last point in verse 14 is what's called illumination, where it says, "But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him." So again, sometimes we're going to try to communicate something, and they're going to say, "That's foolish. I don't get what you're saying. Because the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God. For they are foolishness to him, nor can he know them, because they're spiritually discerned. So one of the benefits of having a relationship with Christ, with being part of his church, is that is that you have this opportunity to learn spiritual things. So in summary, people can come to understand physical things. God's Spirit is needed for people to discern spiritual things. So within that boundary, we're going to talk now about the idea of changing minds. I list here and I say that there's lots of physical issues out there that Christians come up against. So when we turn on the TV and see what's happening in the news, there's lots of things that are potentially spiritual items, but there's lots of things that are physical things as well. And as Christians, we come up against those things, and we have opinions, and we're trying to express those opinions to our family members, our co-workers. And again, the hope is that we can express it in a way that they say, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and that makes some sense. I understand now. And I give some examples of some of the things that we might want to change people's minds on, some of the things that are physical things. For example, governance. And I list there progressivism and socialism. In the past, Adrian and Bill Watson have given messages talking about the dangers of progressivism, this far-left thinking that is becoming more and more prevalent in the United States and in Canada. And the dangers to progressivism or socialism is that, A, it becomes unaffordable. Every example of socialist governments in the world end up degenerating into, you know, these dictatorships where millions of people die. And the whole 20th century is filled with examples of that, from China to Russia to Cambodia. Lots of examples where people have these lofty goals of sharing and everyone benefiting, but as soon as the wealth is gone, they become these brutal dictatorships. So one of the things that we look for in government is freedom. The Church of God happens to be a fairly small church. We happen, though, to live in a country where we have the freedom to be able to practice our religion. And in certain other countries, in many other countries of the world, we wouldn't be allowed to do that. So in many ways, we're hoping that the open markets, the democratic system that we have in Canada is something that stays, because it allows us to practice our faith and to preach the gospel as well. Another example of physical issues out there is climate change. It's interesting how, why is the church talking about climate change? But sometimes it becomes an issue of climate. Sometimes the people who are so in favor of climate change are more zealous than religious people. Climate can become a religion. And so we bump up against those people. One of the biggest issues with climate change that we might want to convince people on has to do with priorities. Bjorn Lomborg is an author who's written a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist. And he doesn't disagree that the climate might be changing, but what he's saying is to spend a couple $1 trillion a year between now and the end of this century. If we spend $2 trillion a year, the difference is going to be 0.8 of 1 degree. The benefit is so tiny, and all of that money is outlaid. And so what he talks about in his book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, is we can save millions of lives today if you spend a fraction of that money on a problem like malaria. So you need to get rid of the mosquitoes and you need to provide proper netting for people. And you can save millions of lives now with measures like that. And so what he talks about in his book is lots of other priorities that we can have. So it's not to say climate change is not something that people should, ignore totally. What he's saying is that the place that you're spending money is not necessarily the right place. Windmills and solar panels, for example, the benefit from them is tiny. And so to keep investing money in those types of things instead of investing money in research that in what real solutions will be is a big challenge. And so there's lots of examples of these physical issues that are out there that are things that we might want to try to change people's minds on. Some other ones I list have to do with things like abortion or anti-Semitism, free speech. And so perhaps one of the key points that I hope to make in this message is in the box that's listed next. And that's where I say, I understand that people who do not get conservative TV or commentary will think very differently than I do. I understand that they're going to think very differently. When I watch a lot of news that's just on the regular channels, the CBS and CBC and NBC and ABC and CNN, MSNBC, there's all these different news networks, but they tend to be very slanted towards the left. And if people don't get to see some of the other side, some of the right side of the spectrum, it makes perfect sense to me that someone's going to, be constantly saying, well, Donald Trump is a dork, because that's what's on the news every night. They're having a funeral for John McCain, who many would say is a great American. But they keep bringing on commentators to make comments, and even though they're supposed to be talking about Donald Trump, they're John McCain, they're bashing Donald Trump in the same sentence. So I understand if you're indoctrinated with that day after day, and if you go to the university and your teachers are teaching you the same kind of left-wing thinking, socialism, progressive ideas, everything from safe spaces to political correctness to all the gender and transgender politics, the feminism politics. If you're indoctrinated with that day after day, I understand that that's going to affect your thinking. And so the point that I hope to make is that I understand also that they don't have Sabbath services where they get to hear some of the other side of the story. And most people today don't spend time doing Bible study. Most people today don't know the Ten Commandments. They don't know what the benefits of the Ten Commandments are as a way of living your life that's going to keep you out of trouble. And so when we're coming and coming into contact with them, we have the benefits of these tools to help us. And we have to realize that they don't have that. So we don't need to be shocked or angry that they're have their views that they do. We need to try to understand, okay, I understand why you think that way, because what you've seen on TV, what's been constantly bombarding you. In Isaiah 5:20, it says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And just like in Isaiah's day, today we have situations where things that I learned growing up in, as a boy in the 1960s, the 1970s, today are opposite. And so everything, subjects such as marriage, marriage has always been between a man and a woman, and the idea of same-sex marriage, well, if you don't agree with that, there's something wrong with you. And things that were considered illnesses are now celebrated as differences now. Influence and persuasion are major social science areas of studies in universities. For example, in careers in advertising and sales and politics, if they can convince you to buy their car or to buy their clothing, to buy their soft drink, if they can convince you, if they can persuade you, if they can influence you, they're doing their job. That's what their job is. And they go to university and they study the techniques to how to influence people, how to change minds. What tools or techniques can we learn that we might be effective in convincing friends and neighbors and family that we are reasonable people? Some of our ideas they think are just crazy, but we need to help them to understand we're reasonable people, and here's the reason that we think this way. And how can we present it in a way that they're going to understand it and say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. I thought it was just weird before, but now I at least understand now how you came to think that way. The example at the bottom of the page is called the rhetorical triangle. I think this goes all the way back to Aristotle. And what it really is presenting is 3 points. That there's 3 ways to persuade someone, in his view. And so we'll talk about what those 3 ways are. The first one that's listed is ethos. And that's an appeal, either from the credibility of the speaker or the audience. It's a sense of what's morally right or wrong. So concepts such as duty and responsibility and fairness come to mind as examples of this type of ethnos or ethical thinking. I was trying to think of some biblical examples of this type of thinking. And what came to me was some examples where Jesus was talking about some controversial things. So again, when Jesus says something, the people in this room sit up and listen because we understand that he's the Son of God and he knows things about, he's the Creator. He created us, so he knows things about us that we might not even realize. So in Matthew 10:34, for example, when he says, "Don't think I came to bring peace on earth," what does the world think? Jesus came to bring peace on earth and goodwill towards men. Jesus said, "Don't think that. Don't think I came to bring peace. I came to bring a sword and sometimes to divide families, because the words and the way of life of Christianity can be very divisive. Many people don't want to keep that way of life." And so here we have an example of a controversial idea, but because it's Jesus that's saying it, we can understand and believe it. The rest of the world may choose to believe the opposite, that Jesus only came to bring peace on earth. And again, Jesus wasn't saying that every family is going to be, broken and disabled by the teachings of Christianity. But what he is saying is that sometimes it might come to that, and we need to be able to handle it if that's the case. In Luke 13:16, we have the example of him healing on the Sabbath, where there's a woman who for 18 years was bent over with a spirit of infirmity. 18 years. And on the Sabbath day, Jesus healed the woman. And what was the result of that? Well, the result was, the Pharisees were upset. There are 6 other days when you could be doing healings, and you shouldn't be doing it today. And Jesus did. And so here we have an example of the credibility of the speaker. Because it's Jesus that's saying this, we understand that we can be convicted by that. On the other side of the triangle is pathos. And that's an appeal to audiences' emotions, the sentiments, prompting it to accept proposition or calls to action. It's commonly used in arguments such as on topics of freedom and love and happiness. So again, appeals to emotion. So this is where often there will be a nice story that's associated with something. And sometimes when people hear a story, they can associate with it, and then a concept will make sense. Oh, I understand that now. Some examples of that. would be Peter, for example, when he gave his Pentecost sermon, where all this stuff is happening, and the people around are thinking, these people are drunk. And Peter says, no, we're not drunk. And then he goes on and he tells them what exactly is happening. And he tells them about Christ and how Christ was killed, but how he came back to life again. And the words that Peter used were so effective that it talks about people who were pierced in the heart. And then they were saying, what do we need to do? They were convicted by what he said when he told the story about Christ and his life. And that's an example of how Peter was able to change minds through using a story. And it ended up bringing people to baptism, and that was pretty incredible. A few chapters later, we have another example of someone using stories. And this was in Acts 7, where Stephen, who is the first martyr, the first Christian martyr, where Stephen is talking to the people. And he starts telling them the story of Moses and the story of David and the story of Solomon. And he had them in the palm of his hand because he was telling the Israelites about the heroes of Israel, the forefathers, and some of the awesome things. And then about verse 50 or 51, he changes it. He twists, he puts a turn in what he's saying. And he's no longer saying nice things, and he says, but every one of the prophets, your forefathers persecuted, every one of them. And he said things that also pierced their heart. But at this time, it didn't pierce their heart in a way that they were driven to baptism. It pierced their heart in a way that they were driven to murder him. And so we have comforting words in Scripture that say that you don't need to prepare of what you're going to say if you're ever brought up in a court or something like that. That God will give you what words to say. And I think in terms of Peter's words, where he was able to win over the crowd, and how awesome that is. And I think in terms of the words of Stephen, where the words he was given, ended up enraging the crowd, convicting them. They were mad at him because what he said was true, that their forefathers did persecute the prophets, and that they're also responsible for the blood of Christ. And so it convicted them, but in a way that it drove them into a murderous rage. And it happened that Paul was among that group that was there when Stephen was stoned. So an appeal to an audience's emotions can be a positive thing, and it can bring about positive results, and it can be also a negative thing. So you need to be careful when you're using that technique to try to change someone's mind. It could be very powerful. And the last one at the bottom of the page is logos. And that's an appeal to logic or reason, such as often concerned with profitability, efficiency, necessity. And again, if I were to ask for a show of hands, which of these do people think is the most convincing for them? I know for logos, facts. Just give me the facts, and I can then reason based on those facts. That would be the one that I think would appeal most to me. Although I know these stories, the emotional stories, are sometimes pretty effective as well. Who thinks that facts is the most important element? So it seems to be a dude thing. Not necessarily, though. How about emotional stories, the pathos? Is that something that can convince you and change your mind? And how about the other one, the appeal from or the credibility of the speaker? Is there anyone that is very convincing? All right. So again, an example for logos, just the one that came to my mind immediately was the example from Herbert Armstrong's autobiography, where he talked about how his wife was convicted about the Sabbath
not because somebody used powerful words and things like that. Somebody sat her down and said, I'm going to show you a few scriptures. So there's a technique of Bible study called chain referencing, where you just go from one scripture and then you list another scripture. And in the course of listing perhaps a half a dozen scriptures and just reading the words without any editorial comment, Mrs. Armstrong said to the woman, I think it was her name was Mrs. Runcorn, she says, I understand now about the Sabbath. It's right there. I read it in this Bible. It makes perfect sense. And so that's an example how an appeal to logic, here's what the Bible clearly says, can be powerfully effective. So on the next page, there's some more graphics and things. I think Peter has been to the 10 fun facts. I don't know if you want to have a quick peek at that one now. Anyhow, I think Peter had his tongue sticking out, so so it was effective humor. So to continue, I list here something I found in an article that talks about five ways to change a mind. And it talks about different techniques that can be used. The first technique was described as the interview. We have more people sticking their tongue out at the back of the room. The interview technique, and we could use the example of a husband and wife, and they're trying to decide what to do on a vacation, where the husband's thinking, I want to go on a camping vacation, lay out on the ground when it's cold and wet. And the wife is saying, I'd like to go on vacation to a nice hotel room where there's big fluffy pillows and lots of comfort. And the point that was being made in the idea of changing minds is, before digging in, so before this becomes a really rough battle between husband and wife, sometimes the idea of open-ended questions can be really effective at identifying what someone's needs are, what they desire, and that allows you to discover what someone's needs are. And when you know what the needs are, then the idea of compromise can happen. So, for example, honey, why don't you go on your camping adventure with your buddies, and then we'll do an adventure together where we go to this really nice resort. And so compromises like that can help change minds when otherwise minds might end up being in conflict. A second point in changing minds is the concept of reframing. I heard this first when reading a book called The Marketing of Evil. And it talks about how, because all these people are going to school and they're learning techniques of how to manipulate people, how to change minds, one of the things they do is they want to change the frame that you see things in. And so with a subject like, the example here, that's given in the handout has to do with during the Depression. The country was at the bottom, and people were still afraid to spend. They thought, well, we better hold on what we have in case this goes on longer. And the president ended up coming out and he made the statement, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself, that better times are coming. And so now is the time to open up and start spending, and that's going to get the economy going again. And better times are ahead. And so what he was trying to do was to reframe the way people were thinking. So don't be worried about, things are going to get worse. We're already at the bottom. It can't get any worse. He reframed it so that people could start to have a positive view of what the future would be. An example that we might consider would be the subject of, say, Islamophobia. The beautiful thing about that word is it cripples you from being able to say anything about Islam. So if you might want to have an open discussion with someone on the subject of Islam, the history, the founder of Islam, and to make comparative comments as, you know, I think that Christianity is better than Islam because of this and this and this. Or I like Islam because of this and this and this. With a word like Islamophobia, it cuts out any discussion, because as soon as you try to say, well, Muhammad was a bit of a weird character because, you know, he married someone that was less than 10 years old and he was involved in, you know, beheading, you know, from morning until night. So some of the practices of Islam are abhorrent, but because Muhammad did it, everybody has to say that that's okay, because nobody that's a Muslim will say that, oh, Muhammad was wrong to do that. He is the example for Muslims. And so the challenge with discussions about, you know, comparing one religion to another to see which one has more merit, is one better than another, can't happen when there's terms like Islamophobia, because as soon as you try to say something, you're a hater. And so it shuts down the discussion. So what you need to do is you need to take it out of that frame and put it into another frame that allows discussion to happen. And so that's the key of point number two in changing minds, is be careful of what frame something is being presented in. Point number three is the idea of make it their idea. So if you're talking to someone about where to go to lunch, you can lead with questions like, you know, would you like it to be near or far? And would you like it to be fast, or do you want to spend some time? And often by, you know, leading with those kinds of questions, you can come to an answer. So I use the example here. You say you want it fast and you want it close by. The clear choice is the Mandarin. Actually, the Mandarin's not close, but that's the one I wanted. And so I'm going to let on like it's his reasons that made it the choice. The idea there is that very often we have ideas that other people share. And when you talk to them, you're going to find out that there is lots of common knowledge, common ideas that we share. And when you can start with that and come to a conclusion based on that common shared knowledge, then we can all benefit from it. And again, it can help change a person's mind. Point number four has to do with customize some points. And so I use an example here of fixing the Canada pension plan. So in Canada and in the United States, the worry is that these government pensions that exist are going to run out. So if you're trying to convince someone of something, sometimes you need to alter the points based on who you're talking to. So if you're talking to someone that's young about the Canada pension plan, one of the things you might, you know, some of the argument or points that you're going to be raising is that, you know, this isn't going to be around for very much longer because it's going to run out of money. And so if we need to do things, if we want it to continue on as a valid plan. If you're talking to someone that's old, that is either on Canada pension or will be on it soon, they don't necessarily care so much about trying to rescue it, you know, for the next 100 years. I only need it rescued for, you know, my lifetime. And so if you're talking to them, that's when you need to, you know, express to them about the importance of making the changes to it that will allow it to be there for their kids. Because, again, they realize they're going to benefit from it, and they also want their friends and their family to benefit from it too. So just different reasoning, but you might have to set up your points a little different when you're trying to change a mind based on what it is you're talking about. An example of that was that came to mind for me was the idea of creation and evolution, that the points that you make on for creation and evolution you often need to customize the way that you're going to approach someone. And so, for example, we know that science has no answer for, you know, why there is life. Science can't create life in a test tube. And so no matter how complex, you know, a system, you know, evolution might be, to say how we got from a single-celled organism to, we'll say, mankind as the top of creation at this time, the process to get from there to there, you know, it might be interesting, but if you can't identify how this came into existence, you know, how life came into existence, then, you know, all this other stuff is, you know, is moot. We need to have an understanding here. Also, the idea of, you know, science, you know, confirms that the universe hasn't existed forever. There was a time when it started. And again, in the what they call the Big Bang theory, there's a time, you know, there's a time before the Big Bang where there was nothing there. So what science says is from nothing, there was something, and then that something blew up and became the universe. And again, science can't explain some of those, how that could happen, where creationism provides an explanation that allows an explanation for that. And so by customizing the points when you're making a case to someone, you can be more effective and change minds. The fifth point that I list here has to do with being upfront about the drawbacks. So if you're going to argue something, for example, stopping abortion, sometimes it can be effective when you say, okay, I understand some of the drawbacks. If we stop abortion today and not allow abortion in Canada, what are the protesters that are fighting for, you know, the right for abortion, women's rights? What is it that they say is going to be the result? Well, they're saying that some women are going to try to self-abort by using clothes hangers. And then they also will say things like, there are some people that just don't want the child. They're not going to be a good parent. They're going to be a horrible parent. And so that poor child is going to be raised in a terrible family where they're not loved and they're not cared for properly. So those are a couple of examples of why abortion is potentially allowed today or why it's become prominent, because those are the problems that go away if you allow abortion to happen. But by being upfront with these drawbacks, you can then perhaps deal with them. We know, that since Roe versus Wade and the change in the Canadian law on abortion, that there's been somewhere around 50 million abortions that have happened in North America, United States, and Canada. And we know that 100% of those babies died. What percentage of those would a woman feel so strongly about that she would try to use a coat hanger? Well, it's not going to be 100%. There may be some that still tried to abort. But giving up 50 million lives because, you know, someone might try to hurt themselves or try to terminate their pregnancy is not a fair trade. It's not balanced. It's not equal. 50 million, killing 50 million to save some is not a balanced argument. The other issue about maybe these would be terrible parents. Well, it's easy to say that, but very often when a parent looks down and sees the little baby, and yes, it might not have been planned, but it's often just as loved as any of the other children that they have. People make adjustments in their lives. And so in most cases, even though the baby might not be planned, it'll often still be cared for and loved. The option also exists for adoption, and that also avoids, you know, the case of murder. So the point is, in trying to change someone's mind, you have to appreciate Here's the arguments. Here's the things that they're thinking of as to why they want abortion on demand and no restriction on it. And what we're trying to present is an alternative that stops. And again, what is it we're trying to stop? We're trying to stop the 50 million babies from being killed. We know that with abortion, it's 100% of the babies that die. And if some of these other means are used, we can stop it from being 100%. And so that's being upfront about the drawbacks in a way, in a hope to change the mind of other people, to realize that many of these problems are not easy problems that are going to be fixed like that. They're complex problems, very challenging, and we need to reason together to come to a meeting of minds. So in between the cartoons and things that are on the page, I list what I think are the two most powerful ways of changing someone's mind. The first one is to tell stories, and the second is to provide facts. We've had examples of sermons here where Mike James was speaking, and he talked for an entire sermon on the subject of telling stories, using stories to illustrate things, and using stories to win over people, because all through human history, storytelling has been an important part of communication between people. Through telling a story, you can incorporate whatever knowledge or facts that are needed to ensure that you're pulling on the right heartstrings, that you're reasoning with people. And so storytelling to communicate is perhaps the most powerful thing that we can use. Providing facts is also effective, especially with a lot of the very structured thinkers. Lots of times, men, when they go to purchase a car, they're going to study all the factors of the car. They're going to compare it with other cars. And it's the facts that are going to help make the decision for them. For them to be able to reason and come to a conclusion, they want to know what the facts of it are. And so providing facts is something that we, for trying to change minds, we have to be prepared to do. In Philippians, we have an example here where Paul's talking about the idea of changing minds, and he's also talking about the concept of being uplifting. So hopefully when we're trying to change someone's mind, we're also trying to bring them up, not necessarily to try to drag them down or to be negative. So Paul says, "Finally, brethren," this is Philippians 4:8, "whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." And then in verse 9 it says, "The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." So we have this example here where Paul is saying, if you've learned it from me, received it from me, heard it from me, or saw it in me, these are the things that you do. So Paul is setting himself up to be the mentor of the congregations of the various churches. A pretty bold to take on that mantle of watch me, and you can learn right way to do things. "These things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." So in talking about facts, just going back to that point again, I list here one of my favorite sites on the internet. It's listed as PragerUniversity.com. And the thing that I love about this site is it has a little more than 300 videos, and they're done by experts in all the different fields. And the videos are 5 minutes long. and it's on various subjects. Everything from, you know, the differences between left and right, free speech. It answers questions like, is America racist? Or answers questions about God, answers questions about Islam, answers questions about climate change. And it doesn't do it with you know, the problem with a conversation with someone is we have terrible memories. And so, you know, someone will pull out a statistic and, well, where's that statistic come from? And, you know, it doesn't make sense, and it's unbelievable. But when you have, you know, a 5-minute prepared message with lots of facts in it, and it's given by an expert who knows what they're talking about, and you can get a transcript of the 5-minute talk, and you can get a fact check of every fact that they list, here's the source of this fact, then if you're talking about climate change to someone, then, you know, they need to be able to address the facts that you present. Because, again, our goal is to change minds. And one of the ways of doing that is to have facts. And so I give this up as an opportunity to have a peek at this site. It's not necessarily a university. What it is a conservative website to present conservative values to people, especially targeted to young people. So they have over 1 billion views. So over 1 billion people or a billion videos have been watched by all kinds of people, and I would suggest that every one of them is great. I've downloaded all 300, and I've made notes on what the subject of each of the 300 is, because they're just that good. I wish I could remember all the facts from all 300. Because that would make me a real smarty pants when I'm in a conversation with someone. But the important thing is, when you see really powerful facts, and sometimes just one piece of information is what I like to call a checkmate. It wins the argument. I mean, you can't debate anymore, because this point is so powerful that one point will win the argument. Usually, one point doesn't do it. Usually, it takes several points. But here's an example of a site where you can harvest some conservative values, and I find it really powerful. So, next point that I list is: do we despair when we sin or fall for a deception? So, for example, we're talking about changing people's minds, and that means people need to admit they were wrong to themselves, not necessarily to you, and then change to something else. And so when we change our minds ourselves, we sometimes are intimidated. And when someone else changes their mind, that can be intimidating to them as well. So a couple of scriptures that came to mind here. When Israel was asking for a king in 1 Samuel 12, verses 20 to 21, it says, "Then Samuel said to the people, 'Do not fear. Do not fear, you have done all this wickedness.' They asked for a king. 'Yet do not turn aside from following the Eternal, but serve the Eternal with all your heart. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things, which cannot profit or deliver, for they are nothing.'" So even though Israel asked for a king, Samuel is saying, it's okay that you've done that. Still focus on God. Still focus on his ways, following, you know, what you've learned. Don't turn aside from following the Lord. So some people think, oh, I made a mistake, I'm going to give up and go that way. Samuel's saying, you don't need to do that. So sometimes when your mind has been changed, you don't need to, you know, give up and go another way because you were wrong all those years. We're human. We're very prone to make mistakes, to have wrong information, and to learn something and to change your mind to now know something new that's correct is a good and positive thing. So it should be something that we welcome. In In 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul once again says to prove all things and hold fast that which is good. So when we're changing minds, we need to prove stuff as well. And the action of proving also means, it requires action. It's work, it's effort to prove something, because you have to dig in and you have to research and find. So when he's saying prove all things, he's not saying, just sit back and hope that something comes to you. He's saying dig in and prove it. So that's action that you need to do. In 2 Peter 3 and verse 3, Peter says, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? How come Jesus isn't here yet? It's been 2,000 years. He said he was coming soon. How come he's not here? So there's going to be scoffers that are going to be shooting off their mouths, walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this, they willingly are ignorant, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, that the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. So the point that's being made there is this concept that there's going to be scoffers. And so sometimes when you're trying to change your mind, they're just going to scoff, and they don't want to have anything to do with you. And you have to realize that some people are like that, and you're not necessarily ever going to win those ones over. And the reason they're scoffers is because they're willingly ignorant. The first time I heard this example was Al Gore in his Inconvenient Truth, where he talked about, if your job is in working for a cigarette manufacturer, and your job is to make sure people keep smoking, then any reports that you see that says that smoking is bad, you're going to tend to try to suppress those or put them down, because your job depends on people continuing in that bad habit. And so the idea of being willingly ignorant, that's an example where people choose to ignore what the science says and to suppress what the science says to try to keep their job. They want to keep their employment. And so we need to understand as Christians and as people that sometimes people have a built-in reason why they're going to want to do something. So, for example, some people are going to want to have free abortions no matter what. Why? Because they don't want God telling them how to live their life. They want to live a life of promiscuity, and they don't want to have children to be a burden. And so they're willingly choosing that way of life, and they don't want God telling them how to live. And so you're not likely to win those people over, because they want to continue in that lifestyle. In the book of Acts, chapter 17, verse 10, it says, then the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea, and when they arrived, they went to the synagogues of the Jews. These were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica, that they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, and also not a few of the Greeks, prominent women as well as men. So here we have the example that's the opposite. So on one hand, there's going to be scoffers you're never going to be able to convince. On the other hand, there's going to be fair-minded people that will listen to what you say. They'll search it out, in this case, in the scriptures, and they'll come to accept what is true. So the point that's listed here is that we need to have an open mind, a fair mind, to legitimate, sincere teaching, not to goofy ideas. There's lots of people that will just come and try to waste your time with goofy ideas, and we need to avoid those. That's just a waste of our time. But if someone is sincere about their ideas and they come to you, then we can speak to them and we can reason with them. And it's nice to see in this example also that Scripture is the first yardstick of truth. So they searched the scriptures to see if something was so. With some of the topics we've talked about, you might not be able to find them in the scriptures. So is nuclear power godly? Well, if we go to the Bible, there's no examples of nuclear power in there. So it's kind of hard to say one, you know, on one side or the other of that particular subject. Is smoking cigarettes a sin? Or is it just a bad health choice? Well, you can go to principles that exist in the Bible, and using those principles, you can come to some conclusions. Some churches say it's a sin. Others would say it's a bad health choice, but you're not necessarily, you know, so they say it's a sin because you're killing yourself and you shouldn't kill. Others would say it's a bad health choice, but there's sometimes people that live to, you know, 80 years old and they smoked all their lives, and so it's not necessarily killing yourself. It's a bad health choice for everyone, but it's not necessarily a sin. And so there are situations where you need to turn to the pages of Scripture, and hopefully, among a group of like-minded Christians, you can come to an understanding and of subjects that are not necessarily, you know, that were not necessarily given consideration in Scripture because they didn't exist back then. In Job, chapter 4 and verse 8, it says, "Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." So the point that Job is making there is, you know, if you're going to be messing around with lawlessness and with trouble, then what, you know, you're going to reap it. So again, the key words there is plowing and sowing and then reaping. So if the thing that you're planting and gardening is evil, then don't be surprised when evil, you know, comes up from that. So we just have to understand the idea that we need to be following godly ways and not following ways that are going to be leading us into lawlessness or trouble. In Psalms 81 verse 11, it says, "But my people would not heed my voice, and Israel would have none of me. So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart, to walk in their own counsels." So what God is saying there is that when people reject God, God will leave them alone. He'll leave them to their own stubborn heart, and you know, people, mankind ends up failing. So that's why we have a lot of the misery that we have in the world today. You know, God is in many ways hands off on many of the things that are happening in the world. But the next verse is pretty encouraging, because in verse 13 he says, "Oh, that my people would listen to me. Oh, that Israel would walk in my ways." So God's desire, he's pulling for people. He's pulling for mankind. He wants us to make the right choices. He wants people to change their minds, to follow his ways. But if they have a stubborn heart, we have to understand that we're not necessarily going to be able to convince everybody. So I end off with some points to consider when trying to change someone's mind. So the first point is stay focused, ideally addressing one idea at a time. When you get into a discussion with someone, it's so easy for the subject just to be bouncing all over the place. And you'll never be able to convince someone if the subject is bouncing all around. So what you often need to do in that situation is say, "You know, that's a good point, and I'd really like to talk to you about that. So I'm going to write that one down, but let's go back and we'll focus on the point that we're trying to talk about right now." And so that helps to stop the discussion from going all over the place, because if someone's losing an argument or a discussion that you're having on a subject, quite often the first thing they'll try to do as a defense mechanism is change the subject. And so if you can keep it focused, you have a better chance of changing their mind. Another idea is to inquire of others. What key points have convinced them to change their mind, and what convinces me to change my mind? So again, I asked at the beginning, if you had any examples of where you changed your mind. And so if you can think of those examples, and if we can perhaps share some examples, then it can be helpful, because then we might learn techniques of what things are effective. Another point is watch and listen. What is effective at convincing each person may be different. And so here we have an example of something that was effective at changing someone's mind. This is from 1 Kings 17. Starting at verse 17, it says, "Sometimes later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing." So this goes back to the time of Elijah, where he pronounced a famine, and then he went to live at this house of a woman who had a child. So a widow had a child. And again, it's not listed here, but in the story, he says, you know, prepare me a meal, and then you can prepare something for you and your son. And so in faith, she does that, even though there's not very much left. But for the years of the famine, there was always meal in the bucket. And so there's a miracle that was presented to this woman where the famine didn't affect her and her child, because there was always meal that she was able to prepare meals from. So anyhow, the child stopped breathing, and she said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" "Give me your son," Elijah replied. He took him from her arms and carried him to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on the bed. Then he cried out to the Eternal, "Lord my God, have you brought tragedy even on the widow I'm staying with and caused her son to die?" So that's pretty courageous of Elijah, because he's accusing God of killing the child. "Lord my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I'm staying with by causing her son to die?" It's a question. He stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried out to the Eternal, "Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him." The Eternal heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. And he gave him to his mother and said, "Look, your son is alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know." His famous words, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of God from your mouth is the truth." So sometimes to change someone's mind, you have to resurrect their child to convince her, but then she knows. So that's an example of an example of convincing someone, but it's a really tough example, because a resurrection is such a rare miracle. But it was effective at changing her mind. Another point is deal with objections. When salesmen and women, saleswomen, address objections head on, it removes barriers. As a salesperson, the first thing they want to hear is, what are your concerns? What are your problems with the product that I'm presenting? Because as soon as they know what your concerns are, and they address those concerns, then they've made the sale. My concern with this toothbrush, there's two or three problems with it, this, this, and this. And then they can explain how those problems are actually features that make it a better toothbrush. And then you look at, then they come back to you, "You know, do you have any other concerns?" "Well, no, those were the only concerns I have." "Well, that's great, then you probably want to buy the toothbrush." So as a salesperson, if you can deal with the concerns, you can change minds to sell the product. The next point I list is that seeking the truth is an adventure. It's worthwhile and exciting, and it's a choice. So seeking the truth is something you have to choose to do. It requires effort, but it's fun. It's an adventure to find the truth. And so sometimes when you're changing minds, you can express that enthusiasm. The example I give here is from the movie The Matrix. They use the example of two pills. There's a red pill and a blue pill. If you take one pill, you're going to go back to sleep, and you'll wake up and you'll be back without any knowledge of what's going on. But if you take the other pill, then you're going to wake up and you're going to realize what the truth is. And it's not necessarily going to be positive. And the last line there, he says, remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. So when we make the choice, in our case, we make this choice at baptism. You count the cost about what it's going to mean to the rest of your life to follow this way of life. But you make the choice, and then the action is you take one pill or the other. In this case. A couple more points, the last couple. One is that the success may mean action is required. Action is needed. And in John, 1 John 3:18, it says, dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. And so part of changing a mind is the concept that when you decide that something else is right, if we use the example of the Sabbath, it's not just an intellectual exercise to prove that the Sabbath is right. It now means that you understand about the Sabbath, and there's an obligation then that you need to do something. You need to change your life based on changing your mind. And so it's important that people realize that success in having their mind changed, or if it's our mind being changed, can mean that we need to change our actions as well. Next point says that we need to realize that we battle against a master deceiver. So again, there's people out there, our family, our friends, our co-workers, our neighbors, who are deceived about things. And they're deceived by a master deceiver, and that being Satan. Revelation 12, verse 9 says, so the great dragon was cast out, that serpent called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So we understand that Satan deceives the whole world. Most of the world doesn't understand that. And so when we're trying to convince other people, we need to realize that the deception that they're under can be very powerful. Ephesians 6:12 says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And so then the solution to that is to put on the whole armor of God. And again, we've covered that in other messages, so I won't elaborate on that today. It's the part of the coat of arms that's the symbol of our church is the armor of God. And it can, as it says here, because we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, it's part of what equipment we need to be fully effective. And the last point just says to remember and to be comforted that in the end we win. God's will in the world and his truth will be everywhere. Today we do our best to try to convince people that what we believe is good and right and is going to be profitable and beneficial to them. Today we do our best, but we know in the future God will be helping and Jesus Christ will be here, and together we'll definitely be effective. And the example I use for that is from a verse we had a couple messages ago from the book of Habakkuk, where he says, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. So again, we look forward to a day when we don't necessarily need to change people's minds. People will have already changed their minds based on Jesus Christ returning to earth. They'll be able to see him. They'll know, the knowledge of God will be everywhere as the water covers the sea. And so that's a day that we look forward to. But until then, we have opportunities to change minds, and we have toolkits. We have some tools that we've been given today to help us have a toolkit where we can approach people and hopefully be effective in changing their mind for the goals of communication and the goals of evangelism.